Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaber.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we are going to be talking about director Billy Wilder, who has been responsible for some of the best films ever produced in American cinema. So Mike, where do you want to start in terms of his early days and his beginnings?
Well, I want to start with some name dropping because I love to name drop. I actually met Billy Wilder in 1990 when he received the Kennedy Center Honors, and with him that night and had a chance to talk with him as well were Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, who worked with him so often in his later career. And the thing that struck me about Wilder, among others, was he was in his mid-80s at that point, hadn't worked for a while, but was mentally sharp and verbally really clever. But that even though he was completely fluent in English, he always retained that strong Germanic accent. And it's a reminder of his origins. He's of a generation of, you know, European Jews who grew up in the early decades of the century. And in his case, in Vienna, goes from there to Berlin, actually works in the German film industry around 1930. And then as Nazism is on the rise, he's part of that generation that will emigrate, that will move. He goes to Paris. He goes to Mexico briefly. He gets to the United States in 1934. One of the amazing things, Marie, about his early career is that he arrived in Hollywood speaking no English at all, and he learned it very quickly. And for a director who's so closely attuned to American speech patterns and American pop culture, my theory is it's what I call a cultural antenna. Coming from another world, another culture, he may notice things that we take for granted. He's struck by things, curious phrases, and just colloquialisms. And so then by the mid to late 1930s, he's working extensively as a screenwriter. And Wilder is particularly known for his collaborations. Early on with Charles Brackett, starting in 1938, later on with IAL Izzy Diamond. And so in that early part of the career, he and Brackett co-write films like Midnight with Claudette Colbert, Ninotchka with Greta Garbo, those are from 1939. And so the screenwriting was always paramount for him. In fact, the studio was often paramount too. And Wilder really loved to sit across a table from a screenwriting collaborator and just go back and forth that way. It's in the writing, that's what counts most.
Well, you know, it is interesting that you say, I was not aware he didn't know English. He's so well known for movies with really snappy dialogue. You know, if you're going to watch a Wilder film, that the dialogue is just going to be very witty and very clever.
Well, you know what? He and his screenwriters, and usually just those two over the years, he and Brackett and later he and Diamond would sit across the table. They would bat lines back and forth. Is it a good line, a bad line? What's the pacing supposed to be? And then when Wilder goes to direct it, he works very closely off that script. He wants the dialogue delivered as written. He wants a certain amount of spacing between lines. He's thinking, as I say, as much as a writer would think, as a film director would. He's really thinking about the dialogue. He's thinking about that kind of literary quality. And you're right. His films are really known for that kind of smart dialogue and really well-timed.
Well, one example, of course, is 1944's Double Indemnity. And one of our favorite lines of all time. I mean, they make a point of showing Barbara Stanwyck coming down the stairs wearing not just an anklet, but a honey of an anklet. It's such a wonderful, wonderful line.
It really is. And it's curious that somehow the Hollywood censors let that fetish go through. I don't know how else to describe it. The fact that Fred McMurray is an insurance salesman, he's making a call on the house looking for the husband who's not there. The wife, Barbara Stanwyck, has been upstairs, taking some sun. She only has a towel wrapped around her. All the innuendo and a byplay there where he was an insurance agent. He doesn't want her to be uncovered and on that way. And as she comes down the staircase, Wilder cuts to a close-up shot of her ankle and, you know, a little bracelet around it, if you will. As he's further, you know, making talk with her, he does that great phrase. He refers to it as a honey of an anklet.
Yeah, that's just such a great line. It's still a great line in 2020. It still sounds exactly perfect. So the following year with Lost Weekend, you mentioned Brackett. I mean, this is Brackett's story. I think the anecdote is that Billy Wilder was actually picked up this book in Chicago when he was on a train from New York to California, read it on the train, and by the time he got off the train, he knew he wanted to make this movie. I also heard there was, originally, it was a typo. It was supposed to be The Last Weekend, not The Lost Weekend. But apparently this was Brackett's true life story, from what I understand. But really different from Double Indemnity in that it's very, very dramatic. But it still has those great moments with the script. You can tell Billy Wilder's hand's been in there with Brackett.
It's actually one of his most serious films. And ironically, it was a box office hit and it won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Billy Wilder won the Academy Award for Best Director. A lot of recognition. So it's always had a high regard critically. And yet somehow within our culture, it doesn't get mentioned all that often anymore. Maybe because it's such a downbeat subject. I mean, it really is about alcoholism. And so either title, whether The Lost Weekend or The Last Weekend, they work equally well, don't they? So I'm not sure which is the typo in a funny kind of way. But it's a film of his that, again, had so much recognition and probably does deserve a little bit of rediscovery for people.
You know, that's a good point. Apparently, Billy Wilder was inspired to make Lost Weekend by Raymond Chandler because in Double Indemnity, he just displayed so much alcoholism that Billy Wilder wanted to use Lost Weekend to kind of explain it to him. So movie making as an example.
One of the curious things is that even though he'd been working a lot with Charles Brackett since the late 30s and into the 1940s, really right up, you know, until into the 50s and then Izzy Diamond later in the 50s. But anyway, the point I'm making here is that there were other screenwriters occasionally. And when you think about Double Indemnity, which was also, you know, written by Chandler based on the James M. Cain novel, Wilder usually got along very well with his screenwriters, but he and Chandler did not like each other. They did not get along. Difficult personality clashes, if you will. And so I think subject matter had something to do with it, but also just frankly, personality traits. They really just didn't get along. They worked together well on a practical level, because yeah, those are really great scripts. But on a personal level, there wasn't much camaraderie across the table.
Well, that brings me to 1950 Sunset Boulevard, one of the classics of all time. If you haven't seen Sunset Boulevard, you should watch it just so you get all the references to it that come up everywhere. And I know you have something to say about this movie, Mike.
Well, I think it's still the greatest movie about Hollywood. I think it really captures its history, its ethos. There are so many inside and not so inside jokes in it about earlier film history, starting with the casting. I mean, Billy Wilder originally offered, the film involves a long retired, essentially forgotten silent screen goddess who's living in seclusion up in the hills, if you will, at Derelict Mansion. Billy Wilder originally offered the role to Mae West. And Mae West, who often talked about herself in the third person, said, you know, when Wilder explained it was about a washed up old movie star, Mae West said, well, Mae West doesn't play such roles. And then at that point, you know, in terms of other people considered, when he offered it to Gloria Swanson, very smart person. She knew exactly what it was about. She knew exactly how to play it. It's one of the all-time great Hollywood performances, if you will. She's essentially playing, you know, the kind of movie star she was. In fact, when she sits in her den and watches old movies, she's watching movies like, you know, Queen Kelly. And her butler and projectionist and so on is played by Eric von Stroheim, who had directed her back in the 20s. And other people like Buster Keaton and so on all pop up at least briefly. So Wilder knowingly inserted actual actors and other figures from that era. So it's a very self-referential film in that respect. One of the things that's actually a curious cultural comment is that whenever we talk about Sunset Boulevard, we think of Norma Desmond, the character played by Gloria Swanson, as this ancient crone, you know, this washed up, and you think she's got to be so old. Well, in fact, Gloria Swanson was only around, I think, 53 or so when she played the role. But at that time, I guess once you got into your 50s, you were used goods in Hollywood terms. And watching her in the film, she doesn't look ancient, actually, as you watch her. She's a middle-aged woman. But in Hollywood terms, if you're a middle-aged actress, you might as well be 90 years old.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things that is explained really well in the movie is how hard it is to be a fading star and how hard it is to go from a different kind of technology, from the silent era, where they valued one thing, to the talkies, where suddenly you were not only old, but you know, you weren't really up to using the new technology. It's such a great example of film noir too, because, you know, it has the, of course, the flashbacks, but the voiceover and the doom that is throughout, because you start off with William Holden face down in the pool, telling you about how he got there. And it's such an arresting way to start a movie. You have to hand it to Wilder for that.
But here's a curious observation, I think, in terms of how Wilder would write such scripts. Think about Double Indemnity. The beginning of Double Indemnity, the Fred McMurray character, an insurance salesman, has been shot, he's dying. We don't know the details, but he's like making his final statement. The whole movie amounts to an extended flashback, and then it returns, it's bookended. You get back to him in the present where he's still dying and then will die. But the whole point is the sense of fatalism there, right? That you know at the very beginning how it's gonna end, and then as you watch it, there's a sense of foreboding. You know, will they get away with murder? Will they get away with all these schemes? And you know they're not going to. Sunset Boulevard is similar in the sense that at the very beginning of the movie, you know, there's a dead man in a swimming pool. There's, you know, and in effect, a dead man is narrating the film. He's showing you how he got there. And so you never have any real sense of hope or encouragement because you know from the beginning that it's not going to turn out well for the William Holden character.
You also get a nice little history lesson about Paramount Studios. You get to see Paramount Studios. Cecil B. DeMille even makes an appearance. That's kind of fun. A fun addition to that movie.
It certainly is, Marie, in the sense that Swanson had worked very extensively with Cecil B. DeMille in the late 19-teens and in the early to mid-1920s, that pairing. And so to have them together again, and he plays himself in the film, that's a crucial point to make. He's still Cecil B. DeMille. He's still dressed like he's going on a safari or something. you know what I mean? It's so funny to look at him. And he's so authoritarian that he likes her, but he still has an active career at the time of this story taking place, whereas he's kind of embarrassed by her. It's kind of awkward, like, you know, Miss Desmond's on the lot. Oh my goodness, what are we going to do with her? You know, being polite with her, but by the same token, he's not exactly happy to have her there. And meantime, she's so deluded, she thinks that, you know, she's back for her comeback performance. You know, in the meantime, we know, of course, she's going to be arrested and let off, but she sees all the police and reporters and all that, and she's, well, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up, you know, and she's got one of those great scenes coming down the staircase, but she thinks she's making a movie at that point. We definitely know otherwise.
Yes, we definitely do. And speaking of cynical, 1951's Ace in the Hole is another one I would really recommend if you haven't seen it. I know you've seen it, Mike, with Kirk Douglas in it as a cynical reporter who stops at nothing to try to get a job at a major newspaper. I mean, it's so topical even for today. In fact, maybe even more so.
You know, that's a really great observation because nowadays, in recent decades, we've had so many movies that comment on what I'll call media culture, on the way in which, you know, events happen and get, you know, fed by the media, not just covered by the media, but fed by the media. You know, they become big stories because of that all-pervasive media coverage, and certainly nowadays even more social media. You see the origins, kind of like the underpinnings for something like that when you watch Ace in the Hole, because you really get the sense of, well, is this a news story on its own, or does it become a news story because of the coverage? You know, it sells papers, if you will. And this is all the way back in 1951, and it's a Wilder film that was topical then, I would say even more so now. And it's a film that people periodically say deserves more recognition for that very reason.
Well, I think he had such an amazing, cohesive career that just spanned so many different kinds of movies and doing them all so incredibly well. I'm thinking now of Sabrina in 1954. And of course, my favorite pick, if you're only going to watch one, would be Some Like It Hot.
Yeah, let's actually lead up to Some Like It Hot in this respect. He had first worked with Marilyn Monroe in The Seven-Year Itch in 1955. She's at the peak of her stardom. She's got that famous scene where she's on the subway grate and the upwhoosh of the air there.
The upwoosh. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you know, I'm making up words. But you know, where that spectacularly white dress gets blown up. And she has the classic Marilyn Monroe response there. She's on the street and the breeze is pushing it up. And her hands automatically pull down tight on the skirt to pull it down, to protect her modesty, if you will. But not too tightly, not too far down. What I'm getting at is, Monroe is a master of sending mixed signals. There's a kind of coyness, a kind of innocence, also a kind of seductiveness. It all goes on at the same time. In other words, it's like, almost like innocence and seduction in the same thing. She's got that sort of, you know, almost Betty Boopish type, you know, naivete sometimes and openness and, you know, gullibility. But then she's also occasionally, you know, aware of her powers of seduction and so on. So when you look at that famous image of her, you know, holding down the white skirt, yes, she is, like, you know, protecting her modesty, but in terms of her great legs, you do get to see the great legs. And I'm getting at, she doesn't like totally push it down. And those are the qualities she really brings to so many of her roles. they had worked happily together on that. By the time they were working together on Some Like It Hot in 1959, her problems had gotten so much worse in terms of her marriages. You know, at that point, the marriage with Arthur Miller sort of on the skids already, in terms of pills, in terms of nerves, in terms of all kinds of things. And, you know, it's a sad life because she had acting talent, but people just saw her as a glorified pinup, you know, like the ultimate pinup, and didn't take her seriously. And why would you marry Arthur Miller? Well, you know, you marry an intellectual that, you know, to have clout. And she would study acting with, you know, Lee Strasberg and his wife Paula and so on, trying to prove that she was a serious actress. Let me give one quick anecdote. There's so many anecdotes attached to Some Like It Hot. While they were shooting it, Marilyn Monroe would always have her friend and teacher, Paula Strasberg, and again, Lee Strasberg, you know, in terms of method acting, just outside of the camera frame. And I was sitting off to the side there. And as they were shooting it, take after take, and there were many takes because she could never remember her lines, you know, she would turn to Paula Strasberg off to the side to sort of get her approval or disapproval. And Billy Wilder, who was definitely the director of this, right, he got to the point where he looked off to the side after one take and said, was that one all right, Paula? You know, where the director himself is aware of that. But again, in terms of her problems, I was only going to tell one anecdote, but try to stop me on that. Second anecdote, Wilder, as we said earlier, loved to have the script delivered as written, right? And there's one scene in it where Monroe has a single line, where's that bourbon? And she couldn't get it straight. And so they did dozens of takes and she kept reversing word order and this and that. And finally, Billy Wilder had the idea of, well, she's in a bedroom, she's at a bureau, and she could open the bureau drawers as she's saying it. And that line of dialogue would be written down on pieces of paper. So when you actually watch the scene, she's looking down and she's actually reading it off a piece of paper. But that's how bad it had gotten. She would arrive on the set late, not being malicious, but just she was just not together at that point. She'd arrive late, she couldn't remember her lines, it doesn't take. And Wilder oftentimes said in interviews that, you know, it was exasperating, but he knew that she was the right actress for that role. So he stuck with it. I mean, he felt sorry for her, but on the set, it was often very difficult.
Well, I think if you have only ever heard of Marilyn Monroe and never seen one of her movies, this is the one to watch first because she's never looked better. She is wonderful in the role. She looks terrific. She wears amazing, amazing costumes. And she was very tragic time for her. You can tell in one of the very, very tight dresses that she was actually pregnant when she was making this movie with Arthur Miller, her husband, but she lost that baby. But it's one of those, you can tell when she's on the yacht with Tony Curtis. And we should mention that the movie also has Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis in it as two guys dressing up as women to escape the mob who they have witnessed killing people.
Yeah, we should mention that it's a period piece. It takes place in the very late 1920s, directly references the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the Al Capone escapade. That's what those two guys get pulled into. They have to make a getaway. Their getaway, of course, is to dress up as women and join an all-girl band, and then, you know, taking a train to a gig in Florida. And that's where they're going to, of course, hook up with Marilyn Monroe. And in terms of all the inside jokes that he works in, you know, when she's walking down a train platform, the train itself briefly whooshes her dress and she goes, oh, like that. And it's a reminder of, you know, again, 7-year itch, right? For about 2 seconds, having a joke that way. Other bits of joke casting, if you will, you know, an actor like George Raft, who had been in the original Scarface as a gangster, here he's playing another gangster, Spatz, and he has the same coin flipping that was so famous from Scarface in 1932. So it's very true to the period, also true to Hollywood history to have, and there's some other older actors like Pat O'Brien and so on who go back to the 30s. And here they are in a movie, 1959, that's set in the late 20s. It was shot in black and white because Wilder had done color tests. And he said that, you know, the hair, the makeup, it just didn't look somehow as convincing in color. And I've seen that color footage and he's right. It just doesn't seem quite right. But for reasons that are hard to verbalize, it didn't seem quite right in color. But in black and white looked perfect. So then he decided based on those color tests, let's do it in black and white instead.
You know, it's funny that even though it was filmed in black and white, I guess I think about it in color because I've seen the stills and of course the front of the DVD box. So you know it's a gold dress that Marilyn Monroe is wearing. So that's what you remember, even though you actually don't see that in the film.
This is a very common phenomenon where some of the older black and white films, when they were released on DVD or let's say a movie poster, you know, that kind of imagery, they would put the imagery in color, right? And you got to know it as color imagery. And then you'd have a kind of bracing reminder, but wait a minute, the film's in black and white.
So Mike, what is your favorite Billy Wilder movie, if not Some Like It Hot?
I would say Sunset Boulevard, because it's such a great movie. It's such a great film about Hollywood. It's exceptionally well made. It's so smart in terms of the casting and the dialogue, and it locks in. But there's that short list of really great Billy Wilder films. And in the 1950s, he almost could do no harm. Hit after hit, you know, or at least strong film after strong film. Almost all were box office hits, and some we've mentioned, but other films like Stalag 17, you mentioned Sabrina, Love in the Afternoon, Witness for the Prosecution, you know, so many, one after another, great run. Few directors have had such a great run as he did in the 1950s, into the early 60s, and then at that point, the career gets a lot spottier, but he had a good decade, not just a good, an exceptionally great decade in the 1950s, and that really goes back into the 40s when he really hits his stride.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I also think he's probably one of the best directors we've ever had in American cinema for various reasons, but I'd say it mostly comes down to the screenwriting and the directing, the way he is able to, whether it's The Apartment, which is another movie I want to mention from 1960, which, you know, you brought back Jack Lemmon in a different role with Shirley MacLaine. There's always that thread where everything still sounds like him, whether it's film noir or it's comedy or, you know, a crime sort of movie like Witness for the Prosecution.
Work well in various genres. I mean, you know, we think of them for comedies, but look, earlier as we were talking about The Lost Weekend, you know, it's not exactly a laugh fest. And so, you know, when you look at the full career, he's really versatile in various genres. What do the films all have in common? As we keep saying, that strong screenwriting. Also related to that, of course, his ability to work so well with actors and why he could work even with Marilyn Monroe, right, who was not easy to work with later in her career. But then in the later career, all those collaborations with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. The films aren't always great, but there's the chemistry there. We feel he's working well with these actors. And chemistry is that ineffable thing that's so all important, that the director and the actors, they're just on the same wavelength. And so in Some Like It Hot, when you analyze individual scenes, you can see just how carefully Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis are delivering their lines. You know what I mean? They're totally in sync with what the director wants.
I think that most of his movies are available on Amazon Prime for people thinking about having a Billy Wilder marathon. If you're not going to pick up, aside from Sunset Boulevard, what would be the hidden gem in his filmography that you would recommend people watch?
Well, there actually are a number of hidden gems there. I mean, his very first film as a director in 1942 was The Major and the Minor, and it's not a great film, but it's a really amusing film. It's a comedy that works well, you know, again, deserving more recognition, if you will. So I would certainly mention that as a just to show how he was talented from the get-go as a director. You know, Ace in the Hole is one that, you know, more people need to know, and that's for sure. Witness for the Prosecution in terms of, you know, dealing with serious political issues and so on. Again, the later career is very spotty. One of my favorites from very late in his career is a film called Fedora from 1978 with William Holden all those years after Sunset Boulevard.
And get him out of the pool.
I know. I have some friends who love it and some friends who hate it, and it's very much a cult film, but it involves very much, you know, the filmmaking process. Now, one of my favorite scenes in it is William Holden plays an independent producer. This is the era when Hollywood studios have been falling apart. It's the independent producer. And he's checking into a hotel, and the clerk there basically just asks him, what do you do? And he says, oh, I'm an independent film producer. And at that very moment, the clerk at the desk says, well, we'd like you to pay now. I mean, what a great, yeah, like in the old Hollywood days, you know, you work for Paramount, you know, fine, put it on the bill. But when you're an independent film producer in the 70s, you better pay before you take that hotel bed.
Yeah, let's see that money up front. So when Billy Wilder passed, the French newspaper Le Monde said, Billy Wilder is dead. Nobody's perfect.
You know, it takes that famous final line from Some Like It Hot and just perfectly uses it there in such a knowing way. Just as Wilder's films often have those inside references, how delicious that this newspaper obituary, you know, is perfectly, again, in sync with something like that. It's a perfect expression of that sensibility.
Yeah, just a absolutely perfect send-off and, you know, witty writing all the way to the end. So that takes us to the end of our program for today. Don't forget to check out our additional episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.